Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
We all have special interests, and the range of hobbies out there is vast and deep. Outhouse racing, soap sculpting, and an annual competition for vacuums.
I built the Suckmaster in 2002. I think it was the first time it competed. Anyway, it's won 3 consecutive years in a row.
With jobs scarce, many people are choosing to start their own businesses. We've all been told at some point that we should do what we love. But can you make money off of comic books?
Hulk! Smash!
Yeah, maybe. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 16th. And the takeaway for me is, you know, I love comic books. I collect them to a certain very, very small extent. And I would be scared, though, to try and make a small business out of them, even in this economy.
You wouldn't be able to part with any of them, probably, is the problem.
That's one thing.
Well, I'm Todd Zwillick filling in for John this week. Let's get into the top stories that we're following this morning. U.S. officials say it's the most significant capture since the war in Afghanistan began. Mullah Abdul Baradar, the Taliban's top military commander, was captured over a week ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani and American raid. He's the number 2 in the Taliban after Mullah Omar, the group's founder. Earlier this morning, we talked to Shaib Hassan, Islamabad correspondent for the BBC. We asked him who Mullah Abdul Baradar is.
There are differing reports about him, but in all respects, he is one of the most important Taliban commanders in this region right now. Some say he is number 2 to Mullah Omar, who's the spiritual leader of the Taliban. He is definitely a very significant person in their military setup. And right now, as far as the operation in Helmand is concerned, which the US Marines and NATO forces are carrying out, he is the central figure as far as that operation is concerned.
Do we have details on how he was actually captured?
No, we don't at the moment, although we know that it was a joint operation between U.S. Security agents and Pakistan's ISI intelligence agency, but there are no details. We know that he was captured in Karachi. Other than that, nothing else is available at the moment.
That was Shoaib Hassan, Islamabad correspondent for the BBC. We're going to hear more from that interview in just a moment.
Meanwhile, explosions are ringing out in the Afghan town of Marja. It's day 4 of the offensive to drive insurgents out of the city, but Taliban fighters are stepping up counterattacks, slipping behind U.S. lines and opening fire there. That, coupled with thousands of hidden explosives in and around the city and steps U.S. forces are taking to keep civilians safe, disarming those IEDs, has slowed the NATO advance. Afghan Interior Minister Hanif Atmar says that one positive development comes from a group of tribal leaders who are now helping NATO troops by pointing out enemy locations.
The operation has full support from our people, especially the special council that has been established from the true representatives of Marja.
So far, NATO says at least 15 civilians have died in the fighting. We'll talk more about that later in just a few minutes.
Senator Evan Bayh, a leading moderate Democrat from Indiana, says he's leaving Congress because the partisanship has become too divisive. This morning, Republican Chairman Michael Steele says the real reason Bayh is leaving is because he doesn't want to face his constituents after he, in Steele's words, sold out his constituents. Taking a look at the markets, Asian and European markets are up, as are futures. The Dow will start at 10,099. The S&P opens at 1,075 and the NASDAQ at 2,183.
Coming up in the show, we talk about your work life every Tuesday. And today, how can you turn what you love into a successful business idea? Do you have an interest that you'd like to turn into a career? Celeste, I'm sensing for you it's comic books.
I don't know. I have a lot of them. It could be needlepoint.
Needle.
Yeah. What about
people
you?
People would pay top dollar for your needlepoint.
They do, actually. What would you
I'm trying to find out how to monetize Scrabble. I think that might be a little bit
that
tough.
That could be a little bit of a stretch.
People do pay for David Bowie paraphernalia, but I'd have a hard time getting rid of my collection, so that'd be cool. Tell us what of your hobbies you would want to turn into a business. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can post on the website at thetakeaway.org. In a few minutes, we're talking about Afghanistan and what appears to be the biggest challenge to Allied troops. Those are homemade bombs. That's coming up.
Hi, I'm Celeste Headley. I'm joined by Todd Zwillick today and all this week, actually. You're filling in for John Hockenberry while he's away. And we have big news out of Pakistan this morning. The Taliban's top military commander, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, was captured 10 days ago in the Pakistani city of Karachi in a joint mission led by U.S. and Pakistani intelligence forces. Baradar headed up the Quetta Shura, the Taliban Leadership Council, which has been instrumental in directing insurgents in Afghanistan and installing shadow governors there. And he's been a central figure in planning the Taliban strategy now at play in Helmand Province, where U.S. and Afghan forces continue a major offensive today. We know the United States has been targeting certain members of the Taliban and al-Qaeda for assassination, but in this particular case, maybe because of the cooperation of the Pakistanis, he was captured instead. We spoke earlier this morning with Shoaib Hassan, the BBC correspondent in Islamabad, Pakistan. And Shoaib, filled us in on the benefits of capturing the Taliban's top military commander alive.
Well, initial reports suggest, although these have not been confirmed, that he is indeed talking and he is giving up actionable intelligence, so to speak, although it's not clear at the moment what that intelligence is. Certainly, he is he's much more important alive than he is dead. He's a very important member of the current military setup of the Taliban, and he will provide intelligence that can be used on the ground in Afghanistan in the operation that's going on there right now.
Did he cross both lines? Was he the kind of Taliban leader who was involved in both the Taliban in Afghanistan and in Pakistan?
No, he was not involved in Pakistan. Actually, we don't know very much. We haven't heard a lot about him in Pakistan. He's only well known across Afghanistan as Mullah Umar's deputy in some circles. But in Pakistan, he's not that well known. That may have been the reason for him to stray as far as Karachi, where he's supposed to have been captured. That's the southernmost port of Pakistan, its largest city. It has a huge Pashtun population. Ethnic group to whom Mullah Brother probably belongs to, but even in that case, it was a big risk for him, and which has not really borne out for him.
And with Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, who we're talking about, was he one of the hardliners? Is his history with the Taliban go far back and philosophical in terms of his dedication to the group?
Well, definitely. I wouldn't call him a hardliner. He's, in fact, said to be one of the people who were willing to talk to the United States and to the Afghan government. He certainly is said to be one of the founding members of the Taliban, one of the first four people who founded the Taliban along with Mullah Umar. One of them is said to be Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar.
And who might step in and replace him?
Well, I'm sure the Taliban have a lot of options. This is not the first time that something like this has happened to them. As we all remember, Mullah Dadullah, who was their military commander about 3 years ago, and who was responsible for all military actions against the U.S. NATO forces, was killed in a special forces raid. And everybody said the Taliban would, back off. But in fact, they stepped up their military action since then. That is from 2004. So I think someone will step in, but it will, in the short term, be a big and significant blow to the Taliban, especially in the current operation in Helmand.
Shoaib Hassan is the Islamabad correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joined us from Bush House in London. And to get an idea about what this capture means in the progress between the tense relationship between the United States and Pakistani government, we're joined now by Christine Fair. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and she focuses on Pakistan and Afghanistan. Christine, what do we know about Baradar? Shoaib just told us that he was one of the founding members of the Taliban, but he was also one of those that was willing to talk.
Well, actually, this is the first time I've heard that, and it's entirely possible that it's true. I think one of the more interesting things about this capture, quite frankly, is that it even happened at all. Pakistan has really come under a lot of pressure from the United States because of its reluctance and even refusal to take action against the leadership of the Afghan Taliban that remain in Pakistan. And indeed, much of the so-called Quetta Shura, Quetta is actually a city in the western province of Balochistan that shares a border with Pakistan, or excuse me, that shares a border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's right across the way from Kandahar, which is the center of the Afghan Taliban. So the Leadership Council was called the Quetta Shura. It had been previously ensconced in Quetta. And over the last year or so, many of those folks have fled Quetta and they've gone to Karachi. I will point out, though, there's a reason why he wasn't assassinated. We don't run drones either in Balochistan or in any other areas except the tribal areas. And obviously, Karachi is far from the reach of U.S. drones.
You know, is it possible that because he was only known as a part of the Afghanistan Taliban, that that's why Pakistani authorities were willing to cooperate in his capture?
Well, no, actually, the logic is just the opposite. Pakistan has really been reticent to do anything about the Afghan Taliban because it has always viewed the Afghan Taliban as its ally. Pakistanis are very concerned that perhaps India will have the ability to develop some strong presence in Afghanistan. And the Taliban didn't do much for Pakistan when they were in power except keep the Indians out. So I was actually quite surprised by this news. Where Pakistan has been most cooperative, it's been on al-Qaeda. Pakistan has never seen al-Qaeda as an asset. And Pakistan has been most cooperative in dealing with the so-called Pakistan Taliban that targets its interests. But the Afghan Taliban, they have been very careful to not do anything that would upset Pakistan. They certainly haven't done anything by way of engaging in attacks against the Pakistani state. So I personally saw this as a really important sign in terms of the progress of U.S.-Pakistan relations and Pakistan really coming to potentially realize that the Taliban is not really an asset for Pakistan over the long haul.
So he is now, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar is now in Pakistani custody. Do we know anything about the interrogation techniques the Pakistanis might use, or would they turn him over to the United States?
I would have absolutely no insight. And if I did, I couldn't tell you that on the radio.
Please, we won't tell anyone.
No, I have absolutely no insight into that whatsoever. I would, if anyone says that they do, I wouldn't believe them.
But it's very likely that whatever he has to say is pretty important.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that the Pakistanis obviously participated in this capture, which is an enormous signal in terms of Pakistani willingness to rethink the relationship with the Taliban. They've always had longstanding ties with the Afghan Taliban. So while they might be interrogating them, let's not underestimate how much they already know.
Yeah, it's true. Christine Fair is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies within Georgetown University. Thanks so much. And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
As we've been reporting all morning, U.S. officials say that the Taliban's top military commander has been captured in the Pakistani city of Karachi. Mullah Abdul Baradar was detained more than a week ago in a raid. He's now being interrogated. Back home, Democratic Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana has had it with Congress. Yesterday, he announced he will not seek a third term in office.
There is much too much partisanship and not enough progress. Too much narrow ideology and not enough practical problem solving. Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
Bayh tells ABC News Americans won't be happy with Congress until Washington changes. And staying with Congress, 86-year-old Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey was taken to the hospital last night after falling at his home. Aides say he's doing fine now.
In Pennsylvania, the funeral is today for the late Democratic Congressman John Murtha. More than 30 members of Congress are expected to attend. Murtha was 77. He died after complications from gallbladder surgery. And at the Olympics, big night for China. Chinese skaters took gold and silver medals in the figure skating pairs, ending half a century of dominance of the event by the Russians. The last time a non-Russian won the event was at the Squaw Valley Games in California in 1960, before either Todd or I was born. That's a look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up, we get the personal stories from two doctors who went to Haiti and have come home very much affected by what they saw there. PTSD among doctors and nurses who treated patients in Haiti.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got your news takeouts here, and here's one about, well, it combines business with privacy with your email. Louise Story, our finance reporter for a partner in the New York Times, is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's go to you first, Louise, because last week we talked about Buzz. This is that new social networking capability, the service from Google, and it lets people share updates like they would on Twitter or Facebook. It's like Google dipping its toe into the social networking water. However, we talked about this last week. There were concerns over privacy because Google let people see all of your Buzz let people see your email contacts. So they're changing that.
That's right. On Saturday, the product manager for Buzz blogged on Google's site that they would retreat from the strategy. This is a rare thing for Google. They haven't had a privacy flare-up like this before. You might remember a couple years ago, Facebook had that privacy brouhaha over showing every one of your friends what you were purchasing on the internet. But this Google one speaks to how common it is for people to be using Gmail for their work stuff. You know, journalists using Gmail for work, lawyers using Gmail for work, doctors forwarding it all. And what that means is in your Gmail contact list, you know, over on the left side of the screen, anyone you've written even just one time, maybe on a very private or maybe irrelevant matter, is there and it's in your contacts. And with this Buzz social networking site, Google was kind of revealing that to a broad swath of people, which really concerned people.
Well, that's a big problem. And the other part of this is that when you're using Buzz, you don't know who's following and reading your updates, because anybody who's ever emailed you or that you've ever emailed could follow what you were doing. It's not like Twitter.
Well, one thing I think is interesting is, you know, for a long time, people, privacy advocates have warned about the corporations following us, about Google or Microsoft, about them tracking us and how scary that is, kind of like a big brother. They have so much data on us. But what actually seems to make people upset is not that as much, but it's when these companies reveal stuff about you to people who know you. So the Facebook thing was about people were upset because their friends would see their purchases. This Buzz backlash is because people are upset that other people who they know will see who they know. And so I think some of the privacy backlash and warnings have been focused on the wrong thing. Focused on these big brother fears is when people, what they really worry about is privacy from people who know them.
Well, you're right. This is one of the first times Google's had to really respond to privacy concerns. That's Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner at the New York Times.
Now our sports takeout with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, while most of the sporting world's been focused on Vancouver and the 2010 games, the NBA is in contract negotiations with its players, and they've made an opening bid, an opening offer to the players. How did the players react? How's the negotiation going?
Well, there's a couple of things that are very interesting here is that the players are very united. During the All-Star break, a bunch of the players' union brought together LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony, two of the biggest players in the league, and they're basically calling, they're saying that the new proposal, which called for elimination of the guaranteed contracts, which is a huge
right.
one, no exception on the salary cap, and a 50-50 split of revenue, that the players are dead set against it.
The players are definitely not happy.
Without a doubt. And at risk here is some of the I think the guaranteed contracts and the salary cap are two of the biggest things that the players are focusing on.
The salary cap. Well, I read a headline yesterday that the NBA says they're $400 million in debt, which to me seemed unconscionable with all the ticket sales and all the marketing going on at the NBA. What about that? Is this playing a card in a negotiation? What kind of debt are we talking about?
David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA, said specifically that because of the current labor contract, that they have been losing hundreds of millions of dollars every year. So he's pretty clear that this is something that they need to shift. There's also an issue with the
owners.
Sounds
like a bargaining gambit.
It is a bargaining gambit, right. And I think part of it is that the owners want to keep their reckless spending and the players want to keep their reckless earning, and that something has to break here. This specific number, we'll see how it projects on next year, but the NBA is an $8 billion business right now, and each team, you know, have an incredible amount of money.
Sorry, you just said $800 billion.
$8 billion.
Okay. Louise Story, finance reporter, almost had a heart attack over there. She wants to cover the NBA instead of Goldman Sachs. That's where the money is.
Well, the players make $5.5 million. That's the average salary.
That's the average.
So the 60%,
how do they live on that?
Exactly. Well, that's funny. 60% of the money for each team comes from the they spend on players. So that's why the owners are focusing that they can cut in that arena.
Still the posturing going on, and we'll see how the end game turns out between the NBA and the players. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. Thanks.
For our last takeout, we hear from you about your Winter Olympics dreams.
If I could be a competitor in the Winter Olympics, I would like to be in the skeleton team. Skeleton is similar to skateboard with ice blades on it.
And you fall down face first. That's Chris in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where, of course, they have lots of ice. We've been asking you all this week what event you would want to compete in if you were going to be in the Olympics, whether it's a real sport or not.
Now, Mark posts to our site, Australian rules curling, that's thin ice over deep water.
Well, Miami Chick writes, bringing home the gold in Olympic après-ski. I'm from Miami, that's how we roll. For those who don't know what après-ski is, we do that in California too. That's going out, having drinks, and hanging out next to the fire after you go skiing.
All right, après-ski. Well, people, we want you to visit thetakeaway.org and give us your best ideas for the Olympic sports that would really turn you on. Tongue-in-cheek is always best, of course, especially a thin skating over deep water. But Sally at least has a real sport in mind. She posts, skijoring with my dog Zeb will bring home the gold. I need to be brought
skijoring up. Is where your dog, it doesn't have to be a dog, could it be a horse or a goat, I guess,
yeah.
But they pull you when you're on your sled or your skis.
Oh,
so it's
okay.
The ultimate in laziness. You can visit our site to weigh up on all things Olympic at thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow we're going to welcome designer and Project Runway's Nick Varios to talk about the controversial ice skating outfits from this year.
He's great.
And from the Olympics to dogs, New York is hosting the Westminster Dog Show. We're hosting our own Takeaway Doggy Competition. Our listeners have submitted hundreds of achingly cute photographs of their canines. It's up to you to vote for best in show. To go to the website, thetakeaway.org, click through all the photo submissions and cast your vote. We're going to announce the winner tomorrow. Later this week, as we do every Friday, we're going to take a look at the people who had a good week or a bad week. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. It's not such a good week for Evan Bayh.
I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry all this week. Coming up, we get some personal stories from two doctors on what they faced during relief efforts in Haiti. That's coming up in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's second-in-command. Mullah Abdul Baradar, the group's top military commander, was captured several days ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani and American raid. Senator John Kerry tells CBS News the raid means Pakistan is now on board with the U.S.
This is really a signal that the government of Pakistan is determined to continue to ferret out those people who engage in violent extremist acts.
Baradar is being interrogated in Pakistan, where officials hope he'll provide the whereabouts of Mullah Omar, the Taliban's founder and spiritual leader.
Meanwhile, explosions are ringing out in the Afghan town of Marja. It's day four of the offensive there, and Taliban fighters are stepping up counterattacks. They're moving among the civilian population and slipping behind U.S. lines. With thousands of hidden explosives throughout the city and U.S. forces taking careful steps to keep civilians safe, NATO troops are making slow progress. Back at home, former presidential candidate Mitt Romney was reportedly assaulted by a fellow passenger on a flight from Vancouver to Los Angeles last night. Fox News says Romney asked a passenger who was seated and reclining in front of his wife to move his seat upright. Police say the man became physically violent and was arrested. And at the Winter Olympics, American Bodie Miller won the bronze medal in the men's downhill. Seth Westcott, also from the U.S., took home gold in the U.S. men's snowboard cross. And today, the men's hockey team kicks off its Olympic tournament against Switzerland. The U.S. leads the medal count with 8. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are up and futures are as well. The Dow will start at 10,099, the S&P at 1,075, and the NASDAQ at 2,183. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
We've seen the pictures and heard the horror stories from Haiti. Doctors from all over the world journeyed to the earthquake-ravaged island to help however they could, practicing what one doctor called civil war medicine. They had inadequate supplies and an overwhelming number of patients in agony. How has the experience affected those doctors' lives since they've returned home? We're joined by two such doctors who traveled to Haiti in the relief effort and each came back with the experience affecting them in very different ways. Dr. Stephen Landau is a family physician from Raleigh. He practices in Smithfield, North Carolina. And Dr. John Ford is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Maryland. Dr. Landau, good morning.
Morning.
You've gone on mission trips before, correct?
Yes.
Including Haiti now. Have you experienced anything before like you saw in Haiti, or was it unique for you?
This was unique in terms of being more intense than anything I had witnessed before.
At more intense, medically or in terms of overall human suffering?
A little bit medically, more injuries to take care of, but more in terms of human suffering. Just every place you would go were tent cities, people sleeping out on the streets and crying for help, saying, "Help, my house is broken, do something for me." Children begging for food on the streets and asking for water.
And now you're back in the United States. I'm going to assume you have a relatively comfortable doctor's life. I'm going to assume that, if I may, because you're a highly trained physician. Difficult to come back to a comfortable and clean and safe environment after seeing what you saw?
Always is to some extent. You go to the Golden Corral, see people eating at the trough.
Indeed.
The comparison is always somewhat difficult.
Dr. John Ford from the Bloomberg School at Johns Hopkins. I imagine that maybe going to the grocery store and seeing the opulence that we have after experiencing Haiti might have been difficult for you.
Absolutely, and I have a 10-year-old, and I find myself constantly reminding him nowadays of, and we'd always done that, but it's a bit more intense now to remember what kids his age are going through in Haiti, so it heightens your consciousness.
Well, John Ford, doctors like you, nurses, are trained to see blood and guts. They're trained to see what most of us would think of as unspeakable sights, and to see a lot of suffering. So we might ask ourselves why it's not just another day at the office for you.
It's not, for a number of reasons. I'm originally from Haiti, and the places where I went and the people I saw are people I would have seen in ordinary life in my first 16 years. I have lots of relatives in Haiti. And it's human suffering, so it hurts no matter where you are, but it had a special resonance for me personally. And but I'm glad, on the other hand, that because of my background, I was able to connect with people and attend to some of their needs. And but the bottom line is that doctors were needed there.
Stephen Landau, I might get a little bit personal if I can. After seeing what you did see, would you describe any of the aftermath to you along the spectrum of post-traumatic difficulties, post-traumatic stress?
An interesting phenomenon. I work with AMURT, which is the Anandamarga Universal Relief Team.
Right.
I'm the president of that organization. And I went with the plan of doing medical relief and also being as president and also being as a meditation teacher, because we are a bunch of yogis who serve the world. And in doing so, I found myself getting revved up and excited, telling people what to do and shouting. And our putative style of what we're supposed to do is what we call coordinated cooperation. And so when I got, and I thought I was being centered the whole time.
It's not very yogic of you, all the shouting, yeah.
Very yogic.
Right.
And so when I got back, I got feedback from the group saying, "Oh my God, what's he doing?" And so I've had to get a little bit of counseling and develop a professional persona to add on to that, what I thought was a spiritual approach, so that I could be calm and functional and be coordinated instead of just running around telling people what to do. And so this has been a growth and development process for me personally.
Now, you're president of the organization that you work for, Anandamarga Universal Relief Team. Your experience leads you to think that maybe your organization, organizations like yours, should provide counseling to doctors and nurses who travel with you to places like Haiti. Are you doing that?
We are trying to do that. What's happened is that the intensity of what's going on, trying to provide food and shelter for people, trying to provide the medical care, takes that, and just coordinating among ourselves so that we're not duplicating efforts and so that we maximize the utilization of the limited resources that we have. You can't even hardly send money down there so easily, and let alone getting goods into Santo Domingo, schlepping them in by truck, trying to get a truck going through customs. And so all that has taken up so much of our time. Even though we do our individual and collective meditation practices, still there is a need for people to process, and that processing takes time and effort. So it's been taking a back seat, and we're trying to get it functional, but
it's difficult in the face of all the heat of the operation.
Dr. John Ford at Hopkins, you went down to Haiti. You're Haitian yourself. You work with Project Medishare. Did anyone at Medishare approach you about difficult things you might see or about counseling after the fact? I mean, you're a physician, but after all, you might not have expected to see what you saw.
Nobody did.
Should they have, do you think? Should they have?
I don't necessarily think so. Medishare was, as any organization, was overwhelmed by the reality in Haiti. And as medical professionals, we are generally aware of what resources are available. But I think that under the best circumstances, yes, that might be an option. But in reality, I think most of the people I know have done really well in the absence of such counseling.
Dr. John Ford is Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and Dr. Stephen Landau is a family doctor from Raleigh, practicing in Smithfield, North Carolina. Both traveled to Haiti on medical relief in the earthquake zone. Thank you both for joining us. Coming up, we talk about your work life every Tuesday, and today, how can you turn what you love into a successful business idea? Do you have an interest that you'd like to turn into a career? Tell us about it. 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can, of course, post to the website, thetakeaway.org, and we'll talk more later this hour.
The iconic Abbey Road Studios, made famous by the Beatles, is reportedly up for sale. The EMI Music Group is looking for bidders for the London property. The studio was built in 1929, and whoever buys it also owns the Abbey Road brand. James Whittington from the BBC Business Unit joined us earlier to tell us why.
The reason is that EMI needs cash fast. Guy Hans, who runs his private equity company, which owns EMI, is in dispute with Citigroup over a massive loan which was used to purchase the record company in 2007. Now, Guy Hans bought EMI for over $6 billion in 2007. He's since said that the company is worth about half of that. He's suing Citigroup in New York for what he says is allegedly lying about the true nature of EMI's finances. And against that background, EMI needs to raise nearly $200 million to meet some of the obligations under the Citigroup loan agreement. So it's quite likely that the Abbey Road recording studio could be put up for sale to try and raise some cash.
Well, they're putting their feelers out there now to see if anyone's interested, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay, James Whittington from the BBC Business Unit, thanks so much. We're now joined by Bill Harry. He was a college friend of John Lennon, a friend of all of the Beatles, and he has fond memories of the Abbey Road Studio. Bill, what is your reaction to the idea that the Abbey Road Studios might be going up at auction?
Well, I feel like the musical landscape that I lived through is being sort of demolished. Like the art college John and I went to, that's been turned into flats. The cabin was turned, you know, it was knocked down to make way for a vent for an underground railway. Now, as long as they don't turn Abbey Road Studios into flats, which seems to be happening with everything in Britain, and because Abbey Road at the moment, it's not just the Beatles. This year, it's been nominated as Studio of the Year in Music Week. Its products are in the Golden Globes, BAFTA Awards, the 52nd Grammy Awards, at the BBC Music Magazine. It's got three rewards for Abbey Road products. It's an amazing studio, a living studio, apart from the iconic image. And it depends on what they're going to do with it, whoever buys it.
Well, you're okay as long as it stays a studio. Do you think any of the surviving Beatles would be interested in purchasing it?
Well, sort of, I doubt it, because like the whole of the sort of banking system, you know, the Beatles company, sort of Apple, is now sort of run by people who are financiers, you know, like the bankers. I mean, everything now seems to be interested in money, not the sort of intrinsic value of anything these days.
Well, I would imagine if Paul McCartney said, hey, go buy the Abbey Road Studios for me, nobody would say no.
Right.
No, and he's got the money to buy it as well.
Bill Harry was a college friend of John Lennon. He lives in London. Bill actually went to the Abbey Road Studios several times, and he was part of the anniversary where 1,000 people recreated the crossing on that iconic crosswalk in front of the Abbey Road Studios.
I'm Todd Zwillick here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, We talk about your work life every Tuesday, and today, how can you turn what you love to do into a successful business idea? Do you have an interest that you'd like to turn into a career? We want to hear about it at 8778MyTake. Post it to the website at thetakeaway.org. And we'll
how many people are going to post that they want to turn their video game addiction into a successful business?
There's a way to monetize it. I'm sure there's more than one person out
Leo
there.
Leo Duran, our producer, would like to do that.
Leo making millions with his Wii. Fantastic. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. As we've reported all morning, U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's top military commander in the Pakistani city of Karachi. They say Mullah Abdul Baradar was detained in a joint raid with Pakistani intelligence. This morning, John Kerry, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, told CBS the cooperative effort is significant.
The cooperation of the government of Pakistan is important, and it's a big transition that is taking place.
Pope Benedict has said the abuse of children by priests in Ireland was a heinous crime. We've just had this report from the BBC's Duncan Kennedy in Rome.
The Pope was responding after 2 days of talks with more than 20 Irish bishops. They've been called to the Vatican to discuss the findings of 2 reports on child abuse by members of the clergy in Ireland. Pope Benedict's statement went on to challenge the bishops to address the problems of the past with determination and resolve. In response, the bishops released their own statement, saying they were committed to cooperating with the civil authorities in Ireland over the paedophile scandal.
That was the BBC's Duncan Kennedy in Rome. Staying overseas, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is warning of a Middle East nuclear arms race if Iran gets the bomb. Clinton is returning to Washington later today. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
It's Tuesday. Elvis means Tuesday here on The Takeaway, and Tuesday means work. Today we ask, have you ever thought about turning your hobby into a business? That's right, the thing you love to do in your spare time just for fun, or maybe because you've got some time on your hands because you're not working as much as you want to. Is there a way to turn that into a moneymaker? Is it possible even in today's economic climate when jobs are so short? Justin Jones Fosu is a leadership trainer, and he's the host of Listen Up on WEAA Radio in Baltimore. And he says that depending on where your interests are and how you go about doing things, now may actually be the perfect time to get started on your mission of turning a hobby into a job. Justin joins us from Baltimore. And Lee Zucker, who turned his hobby, which is eating, into a small business last year, has some advice and insights of his own. He's joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning.
Justin, stamp collecting, a moneymaker? What are you talking about? Really?
you bring up a very good point. And, there are a lot of different jobs that people can get into, their hobbies that they can turn into their businesses. But I want to be careful to say, you know, obviously starting a small business is always risky. Actually, 7 out of 10 businesses actually fail within the first 10 years. But
right.
Despite that number, small businesses at this moment number almost 30 million, constitute 99.7% of all employers, and create the majority of small innovations, according to the Small Business Administration.
And right now the government is tossing a lot of money at small business to try to stoke the job market. So is that part of the mix here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that you're seeing is they're trying to increase small business lending. And actually, on February 2nd, Obama outlined plans for the Small Business Lending Fund, which will transfer $30 billion from the Troubled Asset Relief Program to a new program that will support small businesses in terms of the lending and increase funding for some of the small banks that are giving lending to these small businesses. So I think that what we'll see is these enhancements will actually increase the federal government's guarantees of loans from 75% to 90% and waive fees for business owners.
Okay, so starting a small business might get a little bit easier because they want to make the job market a little bit better for us. Lee Zucker, eating. Now, the whole point of what we're talking about here is turning a hobby at home into something that can make money. Hey, we all like to eat, but I don't get paid for it, so you got to bring us up to speed here.
Okay, well, it's not exactly only eating. I was able to do that and not make a ton of money for
right.
a long time. I started a business called Simple Good and Tasty, and it's about connecting people to local, organic, sustainable, and fair trade food. So it's specifically about eating in a certain way.
Eating in a and what way is that?
It's about really connecting with people who are producing food and connecting with people at restaurants who are providing food in ways that are really meaningful.
Now, in what way was this your hobby before you decided to try to make it a moneymaker? Were you into organic production, into green eating? I mean, this is your passion.
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, I was really interested, but I didn't necessarily think that it was going to be my business. It's when I started kind of really exploring social media in a totally different way, and I created a blog to make sure that I could actually turn something that I was really interested in and really doing a bunch of research in into some sort of at least a commitment to think about it every day and see if I could add anything to the conversation. And then once it became clear that other people were interested in what I was saying and in that conversation, then it was a matter of trying to figure out how to turn that into a business.
Justin Jones-Fosu, I'm just wondering, we have seen a lot of data coming out about the number of people who have been laid off or for whatever reason have ended up freelancing. They're working for themselves as freelancers, which is not the same as starting your own business, but can you turn steady freelance work into a small business?
Absolutely. One of the things that people are seeing is for freelance work, as well as some of the things like local product, green business, technology, that there's a market out there, but people have to really do their research. They have to find out and get some of the market data that may be coming out from the census.gov, as well as other places. And there's actually a really good book that's called Wait Before You Quit Your Job, and it's by the Robert Kiyosaki. And it's phenomenal to outline your process and plan to really take your business or take what you love to do and translate that into a meaningful opportunity.
Justin Jones-Fosu, host of Listen Up on WEAA Radio in Baltimore. We need a little bit of practical, you're full of practical advice, but everybody has lots of hobbies. I mentioned stamp collecting at the top, maybe not a moneymaker. What are the growth areas where somebody who has a passion at home could really turn it into a hot business idea? Because we don't want people just sort of going down a blind alley here. What are the best areas?
Absolutely. There's four areas that I'll highlight today, and one is local product. You know, for those of you who like to keep things in the community, now is a great time. Consumers are increasingly seeking a local angle when looking at where to spend their hard-earned dollar. And what we're seeing is that there's been more than 5% annual growth for the past 5 years in farmers markets, according to Entrepreneur.com. Also, green businesses, and I'm sure that's not a surprise to many. But for the earth mothers and fathers out there doing everything from sewing clothes, diapers, to planting green roofs, this could really be your next business. In places like California, green businesses have increased 45% in number and 36% in employment from 95 to 2008. And only two more. One is tech nerds. You know, it's definitely time to start your business. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, network systems and data communications analysts will be leading occupations in terms of percentage of growth in jobs between now and 2016. And this is one of my favorite, y'all. The Twitter addicts out there, there's actually real work in social media. One of the things that's come across the stage is that 33% of young consumers actually want to see more companies utilizing social networks, and they do believe that it's going to be there. So you are needed if you know how to do it well.
All right, well, let me get on to Lee Zucker here, founder of Simple, Good, and Tasty. Lee, it sounds like Justin Jones-Fosu has you down to a T. You got 4 out of 4 here, local, green, tech nerd, and social media. Is that how you're making your money?
Well, it sort of is. Yeah, I think combining those things is exactly how. The model that Simple Good and Tasty uses is publishing, sponsorships, and memberships, and it's about building community online and offline. I think that's an important piece. So leveraging social media not in a way that we're sort of barking at people what it is we think, but really engaging people in understanding the business and the opportunity and the community and what it is that we bring to that.
And hopefully getting them to spend a little bit of money at the same time so it's not just a hobby but an actual living. Lee Zucker, founder of SimpleGoodAndTasty.com, somebody who turned his hobby into a moneymaker, and Justin Jones-Fosu, leadership trainer and host of our affiliate WEAA Baltimore Radio's Listen Up, joining us to talk about turning hobbies into jobs. Thank you both. Well, let's turn this over to you, our listeners, now. Do you have an interest that you'd like to turn into a career, and just how would you do it? Nancy posted to our site, 7 years ago, in just as difficult an economic climate, I turned my hobby into a business, and it's still going strong. And her love, take a guess, she runs Downtown Doghouse. It's a grooming and retail store in New York. So tell us yours at 8778-MY-TAKE. Post to the website, thetakeaway.org.
Speaking of dogs, I have the Westminster Dog Show going on this week in New York, and our listeners have sent in a slew of incredibly cute dog photos to our website. Now we're counting on you to vote. Go to thetakeaway.org, vote for website Vote for Best in Show, and we're going to have the winners tomorrow. Also this week, as we do every Friday, we're going to be looking at who had a good week, who had a bad week. You can get your nominations in at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week. This is The Takeaway. Here's some irony. As unpopular as the United States Congress is, it takes a senator to make the point.
I love working for the people of Indiana. I love helping our citizens make the most of their lives. But I do not love Congress.
Senator Evan Bayh, a Democrat, calls it quits, saying Congress is too partisan, too ugly, even for a two-term senator, even for a son of a senator, to go on.
There is much too much partisanship. And not enough progress.
Does quitting in protest shake Congress awake, or just let it wave by to another bipartisan pest? Evan Bayh the enforcer, or Evan Bayh the enabler? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 16th. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week. Of course, I'm here with Celeste Headlee. And Celeste, my takeaway is, you know, we have to take Evan Bayh at his word that Congress is just too partisan for him to enjoy it. But it's not like he was elected yesterday. He's been in Congress for 12 years, and his father was a senator, and this is not the first time it was partisan.
It's not. But, you know, even I, who've been covering politics for many, many years, kind of feel like right now it's pretty bad. So I kind of empathize with Bayh. This is the only time you're going to hear me say that about a senator. Let's get right to the top stories this morning. U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's top military commander. Mullah Abdul Baradar was detained over a week ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani and American raid. He's said to be the second in command behind the group's spiritual leader, Mullah Omar, and one of the Taliban's four founders. Earlier, we spoke to Christine Fair, a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She said she was surprised that Pakistan had helped the CIA track down Mullah Baradar, because traditionally, Pakistan has seen the Taliban as an ally.
Pakistan has really come under a lot of pressure from the United States because of its reluctance and even refusal to take action against the leadership of the Afghan Taliban that remain in Pakistan.
Baradar is being held in Pakistan, where officials hope he'll provide the whereabouts of Mullah Omar, the Taliban's founder and spiritual leader. Meanwhile, across the border in Afghanistan, the battle continues for the city of Marja. U.S. officials say half the town's Taliban have either fled or been killed, but those left behind have been stepping up their counterattacks and slowing down the NATO advance.
Here at home, you heard us talking about it just a few minutes ago. Senator Evan Bayh, a leading moderate Democrat from Indiana, says he will not run for re-election this year. He cited the toxic atmosphere in Congress as his main reason. We're joined now by Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Adam, good morning.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. How much of a surprise, really? I mean, I was in the Senate a week ago. Evan Bayh was introducing major legislation on debt reduction. He's been raising money like crazy. Was this really a big surprise?
Yeah, I mean, people around him had a sense that he was uncomfortable with the job and had been thinking about leaving. But the timing of it caught a lot of people by surprise. As you said, he's raised a lot of money. He had petitions ready to go. Tuesday's the deadline for filing, so I think you could say people were really kind of shocked by this.
He was showing a lot of frustration, but didn't really show any signs of wanting to bow out. I mean, people were talking about a race between him and Republican Dan Coats.
Yeah, no, I know. In fact, one of the things that was interesting that was going on, Dan Coats has emerged as one of the leading Republican contenders, and there's been a real considered effort by Democrats, you know, including Evan Bayh's operation, to sort of raise questions about Coats' candidacy, which is a classic sign of the guy clearing the field to get himself ready to run. So it really, really caught a lot of people by surprise.
All right, Adam Nagorny, stay with us because we're going to talk about it more with you in just a moment. Going to the markets now, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up, too. The Dow gets underway at 10,099. The S&P opens at 1,075, and the NASDAQ opens at 2183. Coming up, we'll take a look at Mardi Gras music. We're also looking this morning at turning what you love into a paying gig. Do you have a hobby that you'd like to turn into a career? Tell us about it, 8778-MY-TAKE. Post to our website at thetakeaway.org and learn more about it on our site, too.
Coming up, more on why Senator Evan Bayh is not running for re-election and what this could mean for other incumbents going into the 2010 elections.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here filling in for John this week. We start out the hour with some more bad news for congressional Democrats.
I love working for the people of Indiana. I love helping our citizens make the most of their lives. But I do not love Congress.
There's a statement that's calibrated to hit on the sentiments of the public. Not many people love the Congress these days. That was Indiana's Democratic Senator Evan Bayh saying he's done with the Senate and will not seek re-election in 2010. That unexpected announcement comes at a time when both Democratic and Republican incumbents prepare for a shakeup in the 2010 midterm elections. Many incumbents are finding themselves in tighter races than expected, especially on the Democratic side, probably because right now Americans are a lot like Evan Bayh, and they're not feeling much love at all for the United States Congress. Back with us is Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and also Lisa Mascaro, Washington correspondent for the Las Vegas Sun, who covers Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, who's in a tough race of his own back in Nevada, a Democrat fighting for his seat. Adam, back to you just to start. You have a piece in the Times this morning. You say that Bayh's announcement increases the chances of a Republican takeover of his seat and gets the Republicans closer to really knocking down that Democratic majority in the Senate. Why does Indiana carry so much weight as a bellwether here?
Well, two things. I wouldn't look at it so much as a bellwether, but it's a state where Democrats controlled by seat, and it's still a Republican-leaning state, notwithstanding the fact that President Obama won there last time. Remember, that was the first time a Democratic president had won there since, I think, Johnson in 64, off the top of my head. So it's not an easy state for Democrats. You know, Evan Bayh is one person that Democrats thought could, you know, win that seat again. And if it was, Republicans were going to make an effort against him. I think he was going to win. So that's why it's bad news for Democrats. I still think that the Republicans have a long way to go to take control back of the Senate. I mean, the Democrats now have a 59-41 advantage there. And 9 seats are a lot of seats. Now, there are a lot of Democratic seats in play, including Harry Reid's, as you just said. But the Republicans also have to hold on to a bunch of seats as well, including, you know, where they could have problems, open seats, Kentucky, Missouri, Ohio, New Hampshire. So, I think clearly the Democrats are going to suffer some losses and probably significant ones. I'm not quite sure they're going to lose control. But
right. A lot of retirements on both sides.
Yes, sir.
You know, Bayh's reasons for leaving were different than somebody like Senator Chris Dodd, who's also decided not to run for re-election. Dodd basically said, I've seen my numbers. They are bad. I can't win. I'd rather leave than risk losing. Evan Bayh said nothing of the sort. He just said, I can't stand the atmosphere anymore. Do we take him at his word, or does Evan Bayh know something about his prospects that we don't, and he's putting sort of the best face on it here?
Yeah, this is a question that we were wrestling with yesterday as we were reporting and writing the story.
Right.
I think the bottom line is that we do take him at his word for two reasons. One is, you know, everything we've heard is that while he might have had a difficult race, he's going to win. I mean, he was in pretty good shape. He had a lot of money. He's popular there. He's won his last two Senate races.
His last name is Bayh.
That's no small thing. He's a member of the big of a political dynasty there, which goes to the other thing. What makes his sort of announcement so remarkable and so, I think, credible, you know, I talked to him yesterday, and he's talking about when he used to go to the Senate with his father, Birch Bayh, like, you know, I think he was senator from, like, 69 to 83 or something like that, a long time ago, and how different he said it was then. He said senators were friends. You know, they socialized at night, and he said they really did, when push comes to shove, put aside politics, you know, when it came to dealing with a crisis. Now, there could be some kind of idealized memory there, but I think it is really true, and he's a testimony to it, to how much things have changed for the worse there. And, you know, I think the takeaway of Dodd was very much Democrats are in trouble and Dodd is in trouble. I mean, that was very clear,
right?
You know, and he was very candid about it. I think the takeaway here is that something is really wrong here when a lot of a qualified person like Bayh, whatever you think of him politically, doesn't want to be in what you would think would be one of the most prestigious jobs in the world. Right?
And already the buzz around him, Adam Nagorny, is that he may be positioning for a presidential run. We'll have to see. Republicans licking their chops about their prospects in Indiana and also licking their chops in Nevada. Lisa Mascaro, you cover the majority leader, Harry Reid, who's in a tough race. Majority leaders don't usually lose their races at home, but it can happen. How is Harry Reid polling right now?
Hi, Todd. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure.
You know, Reid's polling in Nevada, the outside polling that we've seen shows him just really facing an uphill battle. He's, you know, down in the almost George W. Bush territory, you know, in the 30s. Reid's own internal polling, which his campaign has not released, shows him faring better I should say the polling that's out there also shows Reid at this point, frankly, losing to the potential Republican matchups in this state. Again, Reid's own internal polling, says he's doing better than that. So Senator Reid faces a really uphill battle. Back home, it's an interesting situation. He's been in office. This will be his fifth term he's seeking as a senator, and often in a small state like this, where someone has achieved so much power and clout and is able to sort of do so much for his state, that engenders them to their folks back home. And in Nevada, you kind of have the opposite effect, where there's a little bit of what people call Reid fatigue, where they kind of want to know, what have you done for me lately? And, with the economy so bad in Nevada, with the foreclosure crisis and the lack of tourism really hurting the gaming industry, folks are really looking to Reid as what is your powerful position done for us?
So it's a skittish year for all incumbents. But I want to ask you about Reid's position in particular. With Congress being as unpopular as it is, I'm going to be charitable and say their approval rating is 16% at the top end. Maybe
yeah.
Celeste, you've been quoting numbers like 13, yeah. Abysmal. Somebody who's a majority leader is inextricably tied to that, right? He cannot separate himself from the poor approval ratings of the Congress.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you've seen Republicans early on go after Reid as the majority leader from the time, even when he was the minority leader before Democrats had control of Congress in 07. Republicans really sort of putting that target on his back, hoping to do to him what they did to Senator Tom Daschle in South Dakota back in 04, really tying him to that. And I think you really see it on health care, too, where, the big health care debate, that was Reid's bill. Reid eventually crafted that bill, merging those bills together. So he really has ownership of that. Some people think in an odd way that could help him in the end. But I think conventional wisdom says that, these things that people don't like coming from Washington, have Reid's name all over it.
And Harry Reid has turned the agenda now to jobs, 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 as he says it, not just a jobs bill, but a jobs agenda, trying to save the Democrats as well as himself. Lisa Mascaro, Washington correspondent for the Las Vegas Sun, and of course Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for the New York Times. Those are Democrats in the Senate and a skittish 2010 election. Thank you. Now let's check in on some stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Officials say a joint CIA-Pakistani operation is responsible for the arrest of a top Afghan Taliban leader. Mullah Abdul Baradar was arrested in the Pakistani city of Karachi over a week ago. He oversaw the group's military operations, finances, and leadership council. This morning, Senator John Kerry told CBS the operation represents significant progress in U.S.-Pakistani relations. Later this hour, we'll find out why we're only learning about the capture more than a week later with New York Times executive editor Bill Keller. In Afghanistan, U.S. Marines are pushing further into the Taliban stronghold of Marja. It's the fourth day of the offensive, and militants have reportedly stepped up their counterattack. And in Haiti now, the Canadian government says it'll spend $12 million to build the Haitian government a temporary base. The new base will accommodate key ministries for up to a year.
In Pennsylvania, the funeral is today for late Democratic Congressman John Murtha. More than 30 members of Congress are expected to attend. Murtha was 77 and died after complications from gallbladder surgery. At the Olympics, men's snowboard cross gold medalist Seth Westcott says he's excited to have won the only two gold medals ever awarded in the event.
Amazing to to be able to do that as part of the history of snowboarding.
Also at the game, skier Bodie Miller won bronze in the men's alpine downhill. The U.S. leads the medal count with 8. And finally, it's Fat Tuesday, and despite cold temperatures in New Orleans, the festivities at Mardi Gras continue today with a variety of marching clubs. Last night, people partied on Bourbon Street in the French Quarter until the wee hours. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we talk about the Winter Olympics and the start of men's hockey. That's coming up in just a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the news stories that we're following this week. We want you to stay on top of. President Obama is facing new opposition to his plan for limiting the size of banks. The opposition is coming from the European Union. Finance ministers in the EU have united against the so-called Volcker rule, which would prevent commercial banks from owning hedge funds and taking excessive risk. The shorthand for this is kind of too big to fail, or letting the banks get entangled in too many financial instruments that got them in trouble in the first place. New York Times finance reporter and contributor to the Takeaway, Luis Story, is here with us in studio. Morning, Luis.
Morning.
Luis, what is President Obama trying to do, and frankly, why would Europe have a problem with it?
So this is known as the Volcker Rule.
The Volcker Rule.
Yes, because the former head of the Federal Reserve has proposed it, Paul Volcker. But what it says is that banks that take deposits and make loans, those very activities that we want to preserve, those are the activities that called for us to rescue banks. Banks that do those activities should not also do risky trading and own hedge funds or private equity firms. So it's calling for a separation of banking, deposit-taking, lending from risky trading.
Keeping banks a little bit in the safety zone, in other words, to do what they were meant to do.
That's what it's supposed to do. Now,
the EU has a problem with this, apparently.
Right. So Bloomberg News uncovered this memo that shows that the EU is going to be coming out, the finance minister saying that they think that this is not a good idea. And in particular, the finance ministers over in Europe are concerned that this would push risk out of the financial system. And this opens a fundamental debate. So in the U.S., the Obama proposal talks about it being good to push the risk away from these big banks, okay? Because then if we won't bail out banks in the future that do these trading activities. But then in Europe, they're saying, well, we need to keep the risk in the system because that's what we monitor. That's what we can control. Mm-hmm. That's what we can handle. And the fear is that if you push things out of the system, they're in the shadows, you don't really know what's going on, and they may cause even greater risk. So it's a fundamental debate over this.
I can envision analysts down on Wall Street at the firms that you cover sort of secretly saying, yes, go EU.
Yeah.
Standing up for them at a time when maybe they can't because they're not popular enough to stand up against the Volcker Rule.
They may be rooting for that. You know, also today, Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, has an opinion piece in the Times where he talks about how important it is that we pass financial reform. And, Paulson's the former CEO of Goldman, so he has both the government perspective and the banking perspective, but he said we've got to pass the financial reform, and in particular, he says it's very important to have a systemic risk regulator, someone who's watching all the risk. That's a proposal that's sort of fallen off the table.
Okay, but in the world, but quickly though, if Obama succeeds here in the United States with Paulson's backing for major financial reform and Europe doesn't come along in the world of interconnected banking, what does that really mean?
Well, the EU will do their own version, of course. The fear is if one country has much harsher rules, will banks move more of their activities to other countries?
Just fly to where you can make more money because you can take more risk. All right, Luis Story, finance reporter for The New York Times and contributor here at The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us.
For our next takeout, let's go to Vancouver for the Olympics. And we're joined by Dan Friedel. He's covering the Winter Games, and he's specifically got his eye on hockey, which makes you one of about a million or so in Canada, right? I mean, if you're talking about hockey, Canadians are hockey fanatics. That must add an actual bit of excitement to the beginning of the men's hockey.
Yeah, you'd have to say there are about 30 million hockey fans here, Celeste, and they're all raring to go. You just look around on the streets of Vancouver as the games have gotten started, and there are tons of Canada hockey jerseys out there, even though, as you know, the Canadian Olympic hockey players didn't even march in the opening ceremony.
Well, a lot of people in the United States, of course, are looking to the U.S. team, but they struggled to get a seventh-place finish in Torino. Can we expect the U.S. team to make a good showing in the Olympics?
Well, Brian Burke, who is the kind of bombastic figurehead of a general manager for the USA team, has made it clear that he looked for a team this year that I wouldn't say was bereft of all-stars, but was kind of filled with a new breed of player. And the idea is that he wanted to have guys who didn't mind being the brick and mortar so that the team might be a little bit tougher and grittier and wasn't looking just for all the glory, that they were willing to do the hard work. And, the team is clearly not a favorite because you've got such a star-studded group of teams from countries like Canada and Russia and Sweden. But, they'll probably have a shot to make it into the bronze medal game.
Well, they're facing off against the Swiss today, and that's going to be a tough fight against the Swiss. They've got a great hockey team out there. You talk about all-star hockey players and bright stars in the sport, but we're not talking about pampered athletes here.
Well, just hours ago, when I was coming back from a hard day of work yesterday, I was on the SkyTrain, which is what they call the metro or subway here in Vancouver, with three of the players from the Slovakian hockey team. I mean, this is like Brooklyn Dodgers in the 20s and 30s, where you're riding the streetcar with the guys who you're about to go see in, you know, 30,000, 40,000 seat stadium.
Pro athletes on public transportation.
Yeah, and it was the same thing when I arrived on Sunday at the airport, where the biggest star of them all, Alex Ovechkin from the Russian team and the Washington Capitals, was up on the conveyor belt at the Vancouver International Airport grabbing these giant hockey bags for his Russian and Washington Capitals teammates that had all just arrived from their road trip, the last road trip before the NHL went on its break. And he was, you know, smiling like a kid on Christmas morning, you know, with all these bags to grab off of the conveyor. And I went up to him and I said, you know, don't you have an assistant who's going to do that for you? And he kind of smiled and said, I don't need an assistant for this. You know, he clearly is just happy to be there.
Yeah, I can get it myself. Don't worry about it. Thanks, Dan Friedel is a freelance sports reporter up in Vancouver. He's covering the Olympics there. The U.S. team is facing the Swiss team today. We're going to have more coverage on the Olympics all week long. You can check out our coverage on our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, more details about the capture of the Taliban's top military chief and why we're only learning about it now. Good morning. John Hockenberry is away all week, and Todd Zwillick is here with me, filling in for John. Here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's second-in-command. Mullah Abdul Baradar, the group's top military commander, was captured more than a week ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani and American raid. Baradar is being interrogated in Pakistan, where officials hope he'll provide the whereabouts of Mullah Omar, the Taliban's founder and spiritual leader. Why are we only finding out about this now, more than a week after his capture? We're going to find out from the New York Times executive editor, Bill Culler, in just a few moments. Meanwhile, explosions are ringing out in the Afghan town of Marja. It's day four of the offensive to drive insurgents out of that city. But Taliban fighters are stepping up their counterattacks. They're slipping behind U.S. lines and opening fire. Afghan Interior Minister Hanif Atmar says a group of tribal leaders are now helping NATO troops by pointing out enemy locations.
The operation has full support from our people, especially the special council that has been established from the true representatives of Marja.
So far, NATO says at least 15 civilians have died in the fighting.
Here at home, Senator Evan Bayh, who's decided not to run for re-election this year, tells CBS News he's not leaving his party in a lurch.
I'm not angry at my party. I wish Washington would work better. And I had discussed with Senator Reid as long as a year ago my growing feeling that Congress was just not working as well as it should.
Bayh denies he's got his sights set on a presidential run in 2012. A new federal audit shows the Census Bureau wasted millions in preparation for this year's population count. That includes thousands of temporary employees who picked up $300 checks without doing any work. More than 30 members of Congress are expected to attend the funeral of late Congressman John Murtha this morning. The Western Pennsylvania Democrat died last week at the age of 77 after complications from gallbladder surgery. The markets are now open. The Dow is up about 67 points at 10,166. The S&P is up about 8 at 1,083. And the NASDAQ is up about 14 points at 2,197. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We've been reporting all this morning about the story that our partner, the New York Times, broke last night. It's about the capture of the military leader of the Taliban, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar. The story hit the New York Times website last night, but the Times actually first learned about the arrest last Thursday. The paper held the story at the request of White House officials. And Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, joins us now. Good morning, Bill.
Morning, Celeste.
So explain the delay. The White House called you and asked you not to print the story?
Well, actually, we called them. Mark Mazzetti and Dexter Filkins had the story pretty well nailed down, as you said, last Thursday. They took it to the White House for comment, of course, as we routinely do. And the folks at the White House said, well, hold on for a second. We need to talk to you about this. Several of the people from our Washington Bureau went over to the White House and sat down with people from the National Security Council and the press office. And they said that they were pretty sure that Mullah Baradar's colleagues in the Taliban were not yet aware that he was in custody. It had been I don't know the details of it, but they thought it had been a clean snatch. And they were afraid that once the word got out, other Taliban officials would go deeper underground or start taking measures to cover their tracks. So they asked us to hold off for a while.
Well, I'm going to ask you in a moment what went into your decision to do it as they asked. But first, let me try and get the timeline of events down clearly. Your reporters from independent sources learned about this out of Pakistan.
Yes, Pakistan and Afghanistan.
And then you went to the White House to get comment on it, and that's when they told you, we want you to hold this story.
That's correct.
Until today, or until last night.
Until last night, right.
So why did you decide to do this? You don't always acquiesce to these kind of requests.
No, we get asked to withhold information, not often, but from time to time. Sometimes it's a no-brainer. You know, we have reporters embedded in military operations. Obviously, they don't file information that would put troops at risk. We've had other stories that were much more controversial where we decided that we would publish. This one was not, honestly, a very hard call. Obviously, we were eager to break the story. It represented a lot of resourceful reporting by Mark and Dexter. But there was no obvious public interest reason to rush the story into print, and we are responsible people. We didn't want to compromise what sounded like a potential intelligence coup.
And certainly the story retains just as much power more than a week later as it would have had you broken it right at the time. Is that kind of your thought process?
Yeah, I think that's the thought process. And what actually happened was yesterday our stringers in Pakistan and Afghanistan started calling our bureaus there and saying, we're hearing reports that Mullah Baradar is in Pakistani custody. And we took that to the White House and they said, yeah, we understand. Okay, it's not holdable anymore.
Right. So you published it. Now, you visited the White House in 2006 while President Bush was in office. And you were getting ready to publish a story about domestic wiretapping. And very famously, you were told that if you published that story, you'd have blood on your hands. Was that the kind of dire warning you got from the Obama White House?
Oh, no. No. First of all, this didn't even get to my level. I mean, they dealt with Dean Baquet, the Washington bureau chief. Obviously, if they had felt they needed to call me, I'm always willing to take a call. But it didn't even rise to that level. It was, back in 2006, the conversations were professional and civil. But in the end, when we didn't agree to hold the story as they wanted us to, it was a kind of firestorm of criticism from the White House aimed at the Times. So far anyway, we haven't had that kind of acrimony with this administration, nor as far as I know have other news organizations.
What's the kind of bar that you have to come up to in order to decide that a story is worth holding at someone else's request? I mean, do you have to check in to make sure that the White House isn't making that request for their own unspoken, selfish reasons?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, you don't want to, on the one hand, I don't have subpoena power. I don't have, spies in the National Security Agency. So knowing whether publishing a story would actually put national security at risk is a harder thing for me to figure out than it would be for somebody who's actually in the government. But we do our best job of doing that, and we take these requests quite seriously. I mean, I think the first one that I ever dealt with was when I was foreign editor in the Clinton administration, and we learned that there was a large unsecured stash of highly enriched uranium in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. We held that story until the material was secured. Was not that hard a call. There are others where, to this day, we can't talk about things that we've held out because they would, endanger agents who are working in foreign countries.
Bill Keller, Todd Zwillicker, I want to ask you quickly just the timeline between having the story nailed down in Pakistan and revealing it. You said your stringer started to hear reports in public there that Baradar was detained. Was the Times chomping at the bit to release the story? At what point would you have released it had you not heard those reports in public? Were you waiting from go-ahead from the White House?
Well, we were a little chomping at the bit, yes. But we checked in with the White House every day, and we also checked in with our people on the ground. And when it became clear that it was leaking out, the rest of it was resolved pretty amicably.
Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times. The New York Times got reports about the operation that in which Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar was captured. They got those reports last Thursday. They delayed reporting it at the request of White House officials. Thanks so much, Bill Keller. Coming up, we're going to take a look at Mardi Gras music, all the way from classics back in the 1930s and 40s to the newest incarnations of Fat Tuesday soundtrack music. Remixing Fat Tuesday, coming up later this hour with Grammy Award-winning artist Terrence Blanchard.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Today, the Obama administration will announce a federal loan guarantee to build the first nuclear power plant in the United States in nearly three decades. The plan is part of an effort to curb greenhouse gas emissions and reduce dependence on foreign oil, also a major concession to Republicans concerned over cap-and-trade legislation and a lack of nuclear investment in those bills. The federal loan guarantee will help pay for construction and operation of two new nuclear reactors in Burke, Georgia. Aaron Gould Shinen is staff writer with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you know about the plans for a new nuclear reactor in Burke, Georgia? Over $8 billion we're talking about, is that right?
I think actually about it, and it's done. They're estimating $14 billion for the two different – there's two reactors that will be built there. They're well on their way. They hope to have a construction permit by next year. They've gotten some preliminary permits already from the NRC and from the state regulatory agency, and I think they're real excited about what the president's supposed to say today. They think it'll really help guarantee that the thing gets done.
And how many over 3,000 jobs, do I have it right, that are expected in the area?
3,000 construction jobs, and they're estimating that when the plants are finished that they'll have 800 permanent jobs on site.
Is there an appreciation locally for the national significance of this? As we said, it's been 30 years since anyone's built a nuclear plant in this country.
Oh yeah, no question. The existing plant there, Plant Vogtle, already has two nuclear reactors, so they're used to this process. And they're used to having a nuclear plant in their communities and providing those kinds of jobs. But they are really excited about the possible expansion, the doubling the tax investment, the jobs, and the what they say will be possibly cheaper energy. But yeah, there's definitely a sense that this is something special going on in their area.
Okay, there are plenty of concerns about nuclear power
sure.
out there, of course. What are you hearing in the community from people who might be opposed to this?
Well, they're sort of focusing on two different areas. One is the cost, because a lot of the cost is being passed on to Georgia Power's existing consumers. When the first two reactors were built at Plant Vogtle, the original estimate was for about $2 billion. Ultimately, it cost more like $8 billion. So
now we're up to $14 on this loan guarantee.
Just on the front end, right?
Right.
They're saying $14 billion, so they're worried about who's going to pay for that if there's cost overruns. And then the other real concern about nuclear power anywhere is not so much anymore about safety of the plant, although that's an issue, but it's about how you store the nuclear waste that's created from spent rods and spent uranium.
And what have they said about where the waste will go?
For the moment, they're saying that they're going to build storage containers and things on site at Plant Vogtle. As you can imagine, that's really not a real long-term solution for stuff that could be around for a million years.
Right. Some people have wanted to put this stuff inside a mountain in Nevada. There's one particular majority leader in the Senate who has said that will never happen. I don't know if nuclear waste from Georgia will ever go to a mountain in Nevada. But, Aaron, I was a kid who grew up in the shadow of Three Mile Island. I'm from central Pennsylvania, and you could see TMI from the top of a mountain near my house. The safety concerns, there must be memories of nuclear accidents, okay, even though it was all the way back in 79.
Oh, absolutely. And the China syndrome and all that, and especially after 2011, it's become a fear of terrorist strike, too. But mm-hmm. Georgia Power and the Southern Company are doing what they can to try and temper those concerns. But the NRC has already come back with some concerns over the original design, mostly, to make it safer to prevent terrorist attacks or to make it safe during serious weather events. So there's still a lot of questions to be laid out, but they're making progress.
All right. The loaning process is underway. The construction process soon to be underway. And certainly the PR process is underway for building of two new nuclear reactors in Burke, Georgia. Aaron Gould Shinen, reporter for the Atlantic Journal-Constitution. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley, and I'm here this morning with Todd Zwillick. Coming up, We're remixing Mardi Gras on Fat Tuesday. We're going to take you on a tour through the classics and some newer songs like that one in just a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. We're learning more about New Jersey Senator Lautenberg's condition. This morning, doctors diagnosed the 86-year-old Democrat with a bleeding ulcer. He underwent a successful procedure to treat it and is expected to make a full recovery. Staying with Congress, a day after he announced he won't run again, Democratic Senator Evan Bayh tells CBS News he's not trying to hurt his party.
I am highly confident that we will have a candidate for the United States Senate who will be very competitive and have an excellent chance of winning this seat in November.
Bayh also says he's committed to helping President Obama with his agenda for the next 11 months.
Today, President Obama is expected to announce an $8.3 billion loan guarantee to build two nuclear plants in Georgia. White House energy czar Carol Browner says the announcement signals a new American commitment to nuclear power.
We haven't built a nuclear plant in this country in almost 3 decades. What we're doing is jumpstarting that industry. Not only do we want to build these plants, but we want to be able to compete in the global demand for nuclear technology.
Building those plants is a major concession to some Republicans and moderate Democrats. And finally this morning, the U.S., Russia, and France say Iran's project to further enrich uranium is raising fresh concerns about the country's nuclear intentions. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Carnival time, at least for a little while longer. It is Fat Tuesday today, and this year Mardi Gras parades are going to celebrate the continued resurrection of New Orleans and the victory of the Saints in the Super Bowl, but try to imagine all that going on without music going on behind it. Grammy Award-winning jazz artist Terrence Blanchard and Nick Spitzer join us now. Nick Spitzer is host of the New Orleans-based public radio show American Roots. They're going to remix Mardi Gras for us. Terrence, let's start with you. You're from New Orleans. Your name
yes,
is
ma'am.
Synonymous with the city that you come from in some ways. We just heard Carnival Time by Al Johnson. One of the things that that many people often say about New Orleans is you can kind of tell what the date is by what music is being played because it's so associated with the times of year.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, that's one of the things that's interesting about some of the stuff that you're going to play. I mean, when you listen to Al Johnson, that kind of set his classic, well, it's Carnival Time, sets the tone for me and sets the period from where it was created. But the interesting thing about Mardi Gras music to me is that when you look at all of these different generations of artists who have created their own versions of this celebration, it is a chronicling of the development of music and the Mardi Gras celebration itself.
Oh, that's interesting. We asked you to pick out a song that kind of showed the different influences in this genre of Mardi Gras music. This one is actually about an Indian chief. It's mostly instrumental. It's called Big Chief by Professor Longhair. Why did you pick this song as a big influence on Mardi Gras music?
Oh, this is a classic. I mean, you know, this is one of those tunes in New Orleans, man. I don't think you can grow up in New Orleans without ever hearing this thing. You would have to. I think most people around New Orleans will know the song without knowing the name. It's that familiar. When I was a kid, we always wanted to be able to whistle like whistle like Professor Longhair.
I wanted to be able to whistle Sweet Georgia Brown, like the Harlem Globetrotters song. Nick Spitzer, you're host of American Roots. Can you tell us kind of what are the characteristics of music that's associated with Mardi Gras? How do we know if a song is a Mardi Gras tune?
Well, they often have march beats going with parades and second lines and that sort of thing. And then some of them are little narratives of what the life is like at Mardi Gras, like Carnival Time, or you hear the Dixie Cups doing Ico, Ico, also out of the Mardi Gras Indians tradition. I think it's interesting that both Terrence and I focus on Mardi Gras Indians, that is the African-American, Afro-Creole marching groups, men dressed in these sort of expansive Great Basin West costumes. And so you hear about the Big Chief, and they're singing about, you know, this is the day to be big, to be the big man. And there's wrecks and the fancy parades uptown. But to be the big chief in the neighborhood is to say, I'm important, too.
Well, the lyrics
are important.
Well, you picked, as you said, another one in talking about Indians. This is My Indian Red, Your Pick, recorded in the 1940s by Daniel Barker and Baby Dodd's Band.
The flag, boy, but watch that crazy wild man. The wildest in the lowlands, and you love our queen, queen of New Orleans.
Nick Spitzer, is the era of the big bands in the 1940s, is that considered the golden era of Mardi Gras music?
No, I think a golden era of Mardi Gras music is whenever you're at Mardi Gras in any time or place. I mean, right now we've got all kinds of great mixes of Mardi Gras music happening and new versions, as Terrence is saying. And I just happen to love Danny Barker, and that's a little band that he put together actually in the late 40s. And it runs down all the characters, the queen, the spy boy, the big chief, the wild man. And it gives a kind of an upbeat New Orleans traditional jazz version of it. But you can hear, you know, hip-hop and bounce versions of the songs about the Indians and contemporary brass bands. And so the Indians go on and are a big part of Mardi Gras from the streets out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Cajun music, because you certainly can't talk about New Orleans music without touching on the Cajuns. This is the Balfa Brothers. This is Danse de Mardi Gras. Terrence, one of the things that's great about New Orleans music is that the city itself is so diverse, and the musicians, I guess you could politely say borrow, but they steal all these influences from every kind of music that they're hearing.
Well, that's the part of the culture here. When you talk about gumbo, that's exactly what gumbo is. You know, gumbo is, you know, bringing together whatever you have to make something that's very tasty and delightful for everybody to share. When you started talking about, you know, the Cajuns, the first thing that came to my mind was all of this music, the thing that it has in common is the celebration, you know, the coming together of all different types of cultures to celebrate this moment right before we have to give everything up.
That's right, sugar
days.
And everything else. Nick Spitzer, I want to play for you one of Terrence's songs. This is actually off his recent album, and the song is called New World. Nick, is this Mardi Gras music?
It can be if it's played around Mardi Gras. And also, you know, Terrence is very evocative about things. The new world and the way Mardi Gras happens here, it reflects the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, the French, the Spanish, and, of course, West Africa, mingling in the Caribbean and South America, whether it's Rio, Bahia, or back up here in New Orleans. And so when Terrence does it, he does it with authority from New Orleans. And when he makes that music, he's stating New World and Mardi Gras celebration. Whether you hear the old carnival melody or not, it's really how people use the music and celebrate with it.
Well, Terrence, New Orleans music is, and Mardi Gras music is certainly not set in stone. This is a genre that's constantly changing, and we kind of heard that with the Yin Yang Twins stand up and crunk, that it's so associated with the victory of the Saints, and because right. It came at carnival time is maybe also right. Associated with Mardi Gras now. Is that that kind of sound that's gonna last?
Well, it's very interesting, like, you know, Nick was just talking about the whole thing about the transformation of the celebration itself is kind of represented by this particular song, because it was first of all associated with the Saints. They were playing it at the games every Sunday, and then when we started Mardi Gras this season with the Saints Parade, we heard this song just about on every float that passed by, you know. So now you start to hear the song on all of these other parades, and it starts to become like a Mardi Gras favorite.
Well, we'll see.
And you
got
to know, the Saints all paraded last night at Orpheus. We're all on one float. Reggie Bush are all signing caps. I mean, the Super Bowl victory became carnival. I mean, carnivals
yes.
Every year. You know, but we haven't had a Super Bowl or any big victory in 42 years. So we don't know when that'll come back. So that's almost like been put as icing on top of the carnival cake this year. It's all been enfolded together. And that's a black-white team run beautifully, plays beautifully, and everyone feels carnival happy about it.
Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots, a weekly public radio program about American music. It's produced out of New Orleans. And Terrence Blanchard, Grammy Award-winning jazz musician, also out of New Orleans. Thanks so much to you.
Crunk. Later this week, as we do every Friday, we look at this week's winners and losers in the news with our friends from The Week magazine. Tell us, who do you think's been having a good week and, of course, a bad week? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to the site, thetakeaway.org. And while New York hosts the Westminster Dog Show, we are hosting our own doggy competition. Our listeners have submitted over 100 photos of their dogs, and now it's up to you to vote. So let's Beagle is on there up for Best in Show, but I maintain that Celeste
Beagle... She probably would win Most Spoiled.
She's not eligible. She would win Most Spoiled. Yeah. She's not eligible for Best in Show, unfortunately, but your doggy is. You have until noon Eastern today to vote, and we'll announce the winner tomorrow. And as we follow the Winter Olympics tomorrow, we welcome designer and Project One Way contestant Nick Vareos to talk about controversial ice skating outfits and what makes a figure skater fabulous. Nick is fabulous. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry all week.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway. Happy Fat Tuesday.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.